We'll go ahead and continue with the biblical history of the Middle East and what's been going on over there, and see things that are happening today that now that we've laid the groundwork from the biblical aspect, now we can see what is going on and understand it a little bit better, see things that are awfully exciting that are going on today that I can't explain apart from the Bible for sure. From last week, we saw that in 1917, the Balfour Declaration came out, which basically said the British said that the Jews deserved to have a homeland. And it was at that point, from 1917 to 1947, that some Jews were able to immigrate back to Israel. However, it overwhelmed the British, and so they had to put quotas and limits on it because it was just too much. And so that was a very trying time for the Jewish people as they were trying to get back into Israel. May 14th, 1948, Israel was reborn just like God said in Isaiah, can a nation be born in a day? Well, if God's in charge, yeah, it can. And so I believe that that was the fulfillment of the prophecy. The Jews see that as fulfilled prophecy for Israel to exist again. In 1948, whenever they declared their sovereignty, in the weeks leading up to that date, the Arab nations told the Palestinian people, the Arab people in Israel at that time, to get out, that they were going to come in that next day, wipe Israel off the map, and run the Jews into the sea. And after they had done that, all those people could return and take whatever that they wanted to. Well, by a miracle, nothing short of a miracle, Israel defeated all of the invading nations. And so those refugees now are located in the other Arab countries. And here, all these many years later, there are about 4 to 4.5 million of them now. And I'll show you something that just came up this week that, again, has to do with what happened all that time ago, 40 years ago, or no, 60 years ago. So what we see playing out today is exactly the outcome of what the past history is. In 1967, again, the Arab nations were amassed on the borders with Israel, and they had the Six-Day War. Israel launched a preemptive strike, took out the Arab nations again, took back Jerusalem. They occupied the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and a lot of these things they immediately offered. The next day, they offered that land back to the Arabs for peace and recognition, and the Arabs turned them down. So they said no peace, no recognition, and no negotiations. That was their response. So we saw that with the Six-Day War. And then leading up to today, we saw just a few years ago the four-year Intifada. We were attacked, and one reason we were attacked is because our support of Israel. Ariel Sharon took all the Israeli people, all the Jewish people out of the Gaza Strip in August 2005. Hamas was elected in February of 2006 as the head of the PLO. We saw the war with Lebanon last year. We've seen Hamas take over the Gaza Strip. So it's just a constant turmoil, and we see these things being played out today. Now then, from just a couple days ago, the new Palestinian Authority platform was presented to Israel as far as a peace plan. So the new Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Salam Fayyad, said he presented this and includes the attainment of the Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement consisting of 1967 borders. So again, what they're saying, if you'll just go back to what we had in 1967, we'll be happy. Not really, but anyway, it looks good on paper. So go back to the 1967 borders. We'll have Jerusalem as capital of both states. Again, this has been a constant point of contention in that what the Arabs do is that the Palestinians want East Jerusalem as their capital, and so they tell the Jews, well, you can have West Jerusalem as your capital. It's not going to work because East Jerusalem contains the Old City and Temple Mount. So again, that's going to fall apart. Then it says, in the honoring of past agreements between the two, there's a lot of things that they've sort of agreed upon in the past, so that honors that. And then the platform also calls for a just and agreed upon resolution to the refugee problem on the basis of UN resolution. So here it is again. What do we do with these 4 million refugees that are out here? Well, Israel says, we can't absorb that many. It almost doubles our population overnight. We can't do that. And yet that is a point of contention constantly. Also for the first time, the government does not mention in its political program the Arabic word for resistance or armed struggle. And the Palestinian Liberation Organization Charter, they say the only way to achieve their goals is through armed struggle. So evidently they've taken that word out. So now they say it's a national opposition to occupation. Okay, whatever you want to call it. But just under the surface is, we still want the Jews out of here and we want all the land. I mean, that's still there. And so in response, Hamas slammed the proposal and vowed that it would continue the armed struggle. So just under the surface of all the diplomatic words are, we still want the Jews out of here. This is our land and we want it all. So that's still there. So this was just a few days ago. So now you can see what we have been studying, we get to see played out every single day. All right? So from last week, where we were was with the end gathering. We've looked at the history and the rebirth of Israel, all of this, and I wanted to step back and look at what's been happening in the last 60 years. And from last week, we saw that God, as he gathered the Israelites on the edge of the Promised Land in 1400 B.C., he talked to Moses and gave him warnings for the Israelite people. He said, now then, this land is yours. It's by covenant I have given it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is yours. The land belongs to you and your descendants forever. It belongs to them forever. However, the produce of that land, the blessings of that land, have everything to do with your obedience and disobedience. If you obey me and remain faithful, the land will produce, you will multiply, you will have great blessings. If you disobey, if you're unfaithful, if you turn to idols, he says, number one, I'm going to have people invade you and give you trouble and war. Number two, I'm going to scatter you to distant countries. Number three, the land is not going to produce, it will go barren, and you will suffer. So these are the warnings that he gave them before he brought them into the Promised Land. One of the warnings was very specific. He said, I'm going to bring a nation against you when you disobey me, and this nation is going to be the symbol of the eagle, and they're going to come in here and take you captive. Well, sure enough, that was the Babylonians. In Ezekiel, he prophesied about a nation with the symbol of an eagle. Just before the Babylonians came in, and that's what happened. The Babylonians came in, tore down the temple in Jerusalem, took the Israelites captive, the Jewish people captive in Babylon for 70 years. And then again in the first and second century, this is when Rome came in and occupied this land. The symbol of Rome, the eagle. So again, God has been warning the Jewish people since before they entered the Promised Land how it was going to be for them. Then finally, what we touched on last week in Deuteronomy 28, if you'll turn back to there. Deuteronomy 28. God said, if you are scattered, and he said, if I scatter you to these distant lands, here's what it's going to look like for you. Here's how life is going to be for you. In Deuteronomy 28:64, he says, then the Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood, stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. Among those nations, you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening, and in the evening, if only it were morning, because of the terror that will fill your hearts and the sights that your eyes will see. A perfect picture of the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years. No matter what country they have been scattered to, they have lived in constant dread and suspense. We have seen the outcome of that just in the last century, what has happened to the Jewish people. Until the United States came along, they were the first nation, we were the first nation to offer the Jewish people full citizenship rights and protection. We're the first nation in the world to do that. Up until that point, this was the perfect picture, and it has for all the other countries where the Jews have been scattered. They will find no rest. And that's the way it's been. So now then, God promises, with all these warnings, he's warning them, if I scatter you, if you disobey me, I will scatter you. But then right next to that, he gives these incredible promises. Turn to Deuteronomy 30, verse 1. So all the way through Deuteronomy, he's telling them before they enter the promised land, if you disobey, I'm going to scatter you all over the earth. But if you will turn back to me, here's what I will do. He says, when all these blessings and curses I've set before you come upon you and you take them to heart wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul according to everything I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where he scattered you. Even if you have been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. He will bring you to the land that belonged to your fathers, and you will take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. The Lord your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants, so that you may love him with all your heart and with all your soul and live. If I scatter you out of disobedience, if you'll just turn back to me, I'll bring you home. This land belongs to you and your descendants, and you'll take possession of it again. If you'll just turn back to me, wherever I scatter you to, I'm going to bring you home. Well, then God's infinite mercy, as we saw in our study of Deuteronomy 31:15, something that if we were in charge, we would have never done. But God, in his infinite mercy and prophecy and grace, has a one last chat with Moses. Before Moses dies and before the Israelites enter the promised land, God tells Moses, says, then the Lord appeared at the tent, the tabernacle, in a pillar of cloud, and the cloud stood over the entrance to the tent. And the Lord said to Moses, you're going to rest with your fathers, and these people will soon prostitute themselves to the foreign gods of the land they are entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. On that day I will become angry with them, and I will forsake them. I will hide my face from them, and they will be destroyed. Many disasters and difficulties will come upon them, and on that day they will ask, have not these disasters come upon us because our God is not with us? And I will certainly hide my face on that day because of all their wickedness and turning to other gods. Now write down for yourselves this song and teach it to the Israelites and have them sing it so that it may be a witness for me against them. When I have brought them into the land flowing with milk and honey, the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. Over and over and over he keeps saying, it's a covenant. It's yours. This land is yours forever. I'm not going to go back. And when they eat their fill and thrive, they will turn to other gods and worship them, rejecting me and breaking my covenant. And when many disasters and difficulties come upon them, this song will testify against them because it will not be forgotten by their descendants. I know what they are disposed to do even before I bring them into the land I promised them on oath. So Moses wrote down this song that day and taught it to the Israelites. God, knowing full well the outcome of what the Israelites were going to do, still allowed them to come into the promised land and take possession of it. He says, I know what they're going to do. I've already seen it. I know what these people are disposed to do, so I want you to teach them this song so at least maybe it'll remind them of what they're supposed to be like. But he knew full well how it was going to turn out. So again, this is a picture of exactly what God has done for you and I. Knowing full well that we were sinners and will continue to be sinners, he still sent his son to die for me because that was his covenant. God will not go back on his covenant. He gave his son, Jesus Christ, knowing full well that we were his enemies. He gave them this land knowing full well that they were going to turn away from him. God's infinite mercy. Just another picture. So then, before the Babylonians came in to take the Israelites captive, the Jewish people captive, turn over to Jeremiah 31. Isaiah, Jeremiah. So Jeremiah was he was prophesying a little bit before 600 BC. So a couple decades or so before the Babylonians came in. Jeremiah said in chapter 31, verse 8. He says, see, I will bring them from the land of the north and gather them from the ends of the earth. Among them will be the blind and the lame, expectant mothers and women in labor. A great throng will return. They will come with weeping. They will pray as I bring them back. I will lead them beside streams of water on a level path where they will not stumble. Because I am Israel's father and Ephraim is my firstborn son. Hear the word of the Lord, O nations. Proclaim it in distant coastlands. He who scattered Israel will gather them and will watch over his flock like a shepherd. For the Lord will ransom Jacob and redeem them from the hand of those stronger than they. He said, I've banned them, I've scattered them, but I'm going to bring them back. Now then, the first fulfillment of this, a lot of times prophecy has a near-term fulfillment and a long-term fulfillment. All the Jews see this as the fulfillment of prophecy upon the return from Babylon. He said he was going to scatter us. He scattered us to Babylon, but he brought us back. So that was an end gathering. He brought them back just like he said. So they see that as being fulfilled. Okay? Now then, over in Ezekiel 11, so keep going to the right. Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel. Ezekiel 11, 14. Ezekiel, this part of Ezekiel was just right before the Babylonians came in to take them captive. So this is a prophecy that Ezekiel spoke right before the Babylonians came in. Ezekiel 11, 14. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, your brothers who are your blood relatives in the whole house of Israel, are those of whom the people of Jerusalem have said, they are far away from the Lord. This land was given to us as our possession. Therefore say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, although I sent them far away among the nations and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. Therefore say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I will gather you from the nations and bring you back from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you back the land of Israel again. Again and again and again, the promise is, if you turn to me, I will bring you back. This land is still yours. This is where you belong. So again, right before the Babylonians came in, he promised for this end gathering. Then in Ezekiel 37, we know the story of the Valley of Dry Bones. Yes?
Now, just the verse just there, the above, the Jews interpret that as a reference to the Babylonian captivity.
Right.
Are you saying that references the Babylonian captivity?
Near-term fulfillment. Long-term, it's still a picture of wherever I scatter you, I'm going to bring you home.
See, to me, there's a problem with saying that references the Babylonian captivity somewhat because it says nations,
yeah.
Countries.
Yep. That's one supposition. But the thing is, this was right before the Babylonians came in. So the Jews see the initial fulfillment of that is that was our first end gathering, just like God said. I see it as bigger than that because of what you said, because it says nations and countries,
right.
Not nation.
Right.
But you could still say, yeah, but God is just generally saying, anywhere I send you, I'm going to bring you back. And Babylon is one place. Yeah, good point.
I think that's pretty limiting, because when they went to Babylon, they went to
Babylon. That's right. That was a single place, and he brought them back. I'm like you. I think that the bigger fulfillment is, well, we'll get into that.
Okay.
But specifically, they see that as that was the first fulfillment of it. So in Ezekiel 37, Ezekiel is seeing this valley of dry bones, all these bones in this valley, and God says, prophesy to these bones, and I'll breathe on them and bring them back to life, and that's exactly what happened. Fulfilling the prophecies of the rebirth of the Israel nation. The Jews have come back, they have come back to life. And then I want to point to especially verse 21. Start with verse 21. Ezekiel 37, 21. It says, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will take the Israelites out of the nations where they have gone. I will gather them from all around and bring them back into their own land. I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. There will be one king over all of them, and they will never again be two nations or be divided into two kingdoms. For a while there, Israel is divided in Israel in the north and Judah in the south. It was a divided kingdom, okay? So now then he says, but in the future it's going to be a united kingdom, and there's going to be one king over it. Now, here's where it gets into kind of what Mary's alluding to. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols and vile images or with any of their other offenses, for I will save them from all their sinful backsliding and I will cleanse them. They will be my people and I will be their God. My servant David will be king over them and they will all have one shepherd. They will follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees. They will live in the land I gave to my servant Jacob, the land where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children will live there forever. And David, my servant, will be their prince forever. Well, now, wait a minute. He's saying, whenever he reunites this king is going to be over him. Now, King David lived in 1000 B.C. This is being written in 550 B.C. So who is he talking about? It can't be King David. Who is he talking about? Jesus. We know it as Jesus. He says, I'm going to bring him back, and this king, this new king from the line of David is going to be my servant and king over a united Israel. Well, see, here's the point, and here's kind of what she's getting at. When the Israelites returned, the Jewish people returned from Babylon, captivity in Babylon, they had no more kings in Israel. There were no more kings. The last king of Israel was in power at the time of the Babylonian captivity. There were no more kings after that. So this has to be pointing to a far future time. All right? Now then, here's the point. We know that Jesus came back. We know who this king servant is, Jesus Christ. The Jews are still seeing this as unfulfilled prophecy that before the Messiah comes, we need to have a new king of Israel, and he needs to be from the line of David. And this is going to come up in just a few more slides. You're going to see how this plays out today. So there were no more kings after the Babylonian captivity. So this has to be far into the future. All right, now then, here's the next thing that kind of pieces it together. Isaiah 11, so turn back to Isaiah. So 750 years before Christ, Isaiah prophesies again. And all the way through Isaiah and Jeremiah, this promise of this ingathering, this regathering, wherever you're scattered, I'm going to bring you back because this land is yours. Isaiah specifically says in chapter 11, verse 10, it says, in that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him and his place of rest will be glorious. Who is the root of Jesse? Jesus. Okay? So now then, here's what's going to go on here. We know this as Jesus Christ. Jesse was David's father. So Jesse begat David, and through the lineage of David, we have Jesus Christ, our Messiah. Okay? So this applies to a time after Jesus' appearance. Now then, here's my point. Because in verse 11, he says, in that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that is left of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. I'm going to do that a second time after the root of Jesse comes. Well, see, here's the thing that just has bugged me the last few weeks, and I finally thought this through. Most people believe that the first ingathering was Egypt. And the second ingathering, the second time, was from Babylon. That can't be. That can't be. Egypt was not an ingathering. They had never possessed the land to begin with. That was their first entry into the land of Israel. So the first ingathering was Babylon. When was the second ingathering? It has to be after the time of Christ. That's why I think we're seeing that today. And that's what we'll get into. So he says, I'm going to reach out my hand again in that day a second time. And then in Amos, so keep going to the right, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos. Hosea, Joel, Amos 9, verse 8. Here's what's so exciting about this. Amos 9:8. Surely the eyes of the sovereign Lord are on the sinful kingdom. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yet I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. There have always been a remnant of Jews. There have been Jews in Israel all the time. Most of them have been scattered, but he promises, I'm not going to destroy them all. There's a faithful remnant I'm going to work with all the way up until the final day. I'm going to continue to work with them. For I will give the command, and I will shake the house of Israel among the nations. I'm going to scatter them. As grain is shaken in a sieve, and not a pebble will reach the ground. All the sinners among my people will die by the sword. All those who say disaster will not overtake or meet us. In that day, I will restore David's tent. I will repair its broken pieces, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do these things. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading the grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. That's happening today. I will bring back my exiled people Israel. That's happening today. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They are doing that. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. They are doing that. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. So when I reach out my hand a second time and bring them back, I'm going to plant them there, and it's not ever going to be happening again. Once they are there the second time, that is the last time before the judgment day comes. That's what it says. So where are we seeing the second ingathering? That's why I believe for the last 60 years, that's exactly what we're seeing. And when God says, I'm going to do this a second time, and when I do it a second time, that's the last time. They're going to be there for forever. So this second ingathering, I believe, started mainly in 1948 when Israel became a nation. That allowed them to set all the immigration rules and everything, and they said, bring them on. This is now a Jewish nation. We want all the Jews to come home. Since 1948, almost 4 million Jews have returned to Israel. Over 25% of that happened just in the 1990s. After Russia fell apart, that locked Jews in the Russian homeland that they could not get out, what stood for over 50 years in the Soviet Union fell apart in less than two. How did that happen? I can only explain it is that God needs his people home. He needs Russia to fall so they can get out. That's the only explanation I can point to. So over a fourth of those people immigrated just during the 1990s after the fall of Russia. In May 2006, we reached a tipping point. In May 2006, there are now more Jews in Israel than any other single location in the world. At that point, there are more Jews in the United States than there were in Israel. Enough have immigrated now that there are more Jews in Israel than in the United States. There are about 13 million Jews worldwide, about 5.5 million of them in Israel, and about 5 million now in the United States. And those numbers are changing every single day. So I don't know what impact that has, but it's interesting to note that there are more Jews now in Israel than any other single location. Again, like we saw, yes?
Well, and I think that it's all part of God's plan. He's waiting on the last Jew to return home before the second coming.
Sure.
He's just waiting.
God knows who that is. Yeah. What she's saying is, God knows who that last Jew is, and he's got it all worked out. I don't know his schedule or anything. I do know that he's bringing them home in record numbers, and we're seeing it happen. But he knows who that last one is. He knows how it works. So it goes back to the question we had last year about this time. During the war with Lebanon, there were more Jews from North America that immigrated to Israel than ever before in a single month. Why would they do that? Why would Jews living in the United States leave the wealthiest country in the world, the most secure country in the world? Jews are the most prosperous in the United States than anywhere else in the world. Why would they go back to Israel in the middle of a war? Because that's where we belong. That's what they're supposed to do. I can't explain it apart from that. I wouldn't have gone back during the... Let's redo our tickets and go back later. That's what I would have done. But yet, they broke a record during that time for North American Jews returning to Israel. Why? It's only because God wants his people home. In the last decade, or a little bit more than a decade, the largest contributor to Jewish immigration, of course, have been the Jewish people in the United States. The Jewish people give more money to bring Jews from all over the world back to Israel than anybody else. Do you know who the second largest contributor to bringing Jews back to Israel is? It has been in the last decade or two. Evangelical Christian churches. Why would we be doing that?
Because that's God's will.
It's God's will. You know, part of you are going, yeah, we just want to hurry up and get them home because we know Jesus will come. Well, that may be it. But I think there's a scriptural basis for that. Turn back to Isaiah 49. Isaiah 49, verse 22. Isaiah 49, 22 says, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. See, I will beckon to the Gentiles. I will lift up my banner to the peoples. They will bring your sons in their arms and carry your daughters on their shoulders." The Gentiles will bring them home? The Jews reading this are going, no way. Why would he get the Gentiles to do it? Well, if we're contributing more than anybody else in the second most amount than anybody else in the world, that's why. God's been figuring this out for thousands of years. And there it is in black and white. Yes, ma'am.
Also, you know, where's the verse? The enemy of Jews, I mean, God said the enemy of Jews are my enemy.
Yeah. But they will facilitate. Yeah, I don't know which one. I can't remember which verse you're talking about. But yeah. So he's going to use enemies to carry out his will. And that's what he's always done. So here we are, evangelical Christian churches, one of the largest contributors. Let's get the Jews home. That's where they belong. We believe that. In November of 2006, the B'nai Menashe, this is one of the lost tribes of Israel, the tribe of Manasseh. This tribe of people were found in India. They were exiled by the Assyrians 2,700 years ago. Over the past decade, nearly 1,000 members of this community have moved to Israel. Another 7,000 members of this community are due in. They're waiting permission from the Israeli government to come in. Now then, what's fascinating about this is, here's this group of people over in India that all of a sudden they say, you know what? We have a lot of the same customs that you do in Israel. Why is that? Well, they sent a team of rabbis over to investigate and said, you know what? They look like Jews. They act like Jews. I think they're Jews. Well, just so happens, you know, there's this thing called the Human Genome Project that just kind of started about 10 years or 12 years ago. Up until that time, we really couldn't prove with great degree of certainty lineages and things like that. Well, now then, with the DNA evidence, they find markers that can trace Jewish lineage all the way back as far as you want to go. Guess what? These people have those markers. They're going, I think they're Jews. Bring them home. So there's a bunch of Jewish people in India. The Falashmura, descendants of the lost tribe of Dan. They found them in Ethiopia in the late 1800s, 1900s. In the 1980s and 1990s, they began airlifting these people into Israel. They're Jews. They need to come home. 6,000 more of them are going to be allowed into Israel in 2008. Why is this all happening just here in the last few years? July the 1st, North American Aliyah, or immigration to Israel, will reach a 25-year record high this year with immigrants arriving on 12 flights this summer. The number of Jews moving to Israel from North America has steadily climbed for the past 5 years with 3,200 in 2006 and a 5 to 10% increase expected this year. They're going home. There's no other explanation for it. I can't point to any other reason except that it's time for the Jews to go home. And now with the world situated the way it is, the Soviet Union has fallen, that released the Jewish people. All of a sudden we have a good DNA test for the Jewish people. They're Jews. Bring them home. It all adds up. The Jewish people are returning in great numbers. God wants his people. Anything else about the end gathering that you've run into or thought about? Yes?
The tribe of
I don't know. He says the tribe of Dan is not listed in that list in Revelation as being part of the 144,000. I don't know how that's working. Is God just going to say, you know, you're welcome to come back in, but I'm going to only use these? I don't know. I don't understand it either. Yeah, but that's conspicuous, isn't it? Why did he leave out then? Of course, there's a little history there, too, that they kind of did a few bad things. So anyway, again, I can't explain the details, but we're seeing it right here in front of us, and it hadn't happened for 2,000 years. The dispersion started in 70 A.D. This has not happened for those 2,000 years. So go figure. I think it's God. The other thing that I wanted to talk about before we go forward is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a Jewish legal assembly that we know existed even before Jesus' time. And what happened is the Jewish legal assembly says, you bring us your legal questions, we'll go back to the book of the law, and we will give a judgment on your question. So they are the Jewish legal assembly based on the law of Moses. Okay? It was made up of 70 rabbis plus one, the high priest. So 71 men form the Sanhedrin. If you'll turn to John 11, show you a few instances of what I'm talking about that we know in New Testament times. John 11, 45 says, therefore many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they ask. Here's a man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So the Pharisees were concerned about Jesus and his power and his draw of these people. So they go to the Sanhedrin for a legal decision. We need to do something about this guy. So in Mark 15, verse 1, it says, very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. So now we know that this Jewish legal assembly was very active in Jesus' time. We know that Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, were both members of the Sanhedrin. If you read in the book of Acts, we know that all the apostles at that time, Peter, John, Paul, Stephen, the deacon, appeared before the Sanhedrin in some form or another. Stephen appeared before the Sanhedrin and was sentenced to be stoned to death. Peter, John, and Paul appeared before the Sanhedrin to plead their case as disciples of Christ, to preach the word. So we know the Sanhedrin was very active in that time. Now then, what happened in 70 AD was that when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, the Jews began dispersing in great numbers. As the Jews dispersed, this legal council, this legal assembly, lost their constituents. I mean, after a while, they didn't have enough Jews to stay formed. All of the outlying Jews in all the other countries of the world had their own legal institutions amongst them. Here in America, they have a rabbinical council that goes back to Jewish law. And so the Sanhedrin in Israel lost their constituency. So in 425 AD, the Sanhedrin disbanded. They no longer had enough constituents in Israel to stay formed. That was in 425 AD in Tiberias, the city on the Sea of the Galilee. They disbanded. In October 2004, the Sanhedrin reformed. We now have a Sanhedrin existing again in Israel. The reason they reformed? They said themselves, by Jewish law, we have to have a Sanhedrin. The Bible tells us we have to have a Jewish legal assembly. And now that a partial ingathering has occurred, we have constituents now. There are enough Jews residing in Israel, it gives us something to do. So there are 70 rabbis, of course they don't have the high priest, there are 70 rabbis that have reformed the Sanhedrin. The other thing that the Sanhedrin is formed to do is turn to the last book of the Bible, of the Old Testament, I'm sorry. The last book of the Old Testament, Malachi. God leaves the Jewish people with a word. Malachi 4, verse 5. God told the Jewish people, he says, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes." So, the Jews believe, before the Messiah appears, Elijah is going to come and announce the coming of the Messiah. They believe that the Elijah will appear before the Sanhedrin to make that announcement. So we have to have a Sanhedrin for Elijah to appear before. So we know for the Messiah to come, the Sanhedrin has to be in existence because he has to report to the Sanhedrin. Do you know where the business offices of the Sanhedrin are supposed to be?
In the temple.
In the temple. We're going to have to build a temple also, by the way. So the Sanhedrin is already contracted with an architect to design a tilt-up construction temple. They've got the plans ready. Tilt-up construction is just like Walmart. It wasn't there that day, but it is the next because they've thrown up these slabs of concrete overnight and tied them all together. That's what tilt-up construction is. They've got the plans ready for the temple. The Sanhedrin got that taken care of. So now then they've got the plans for the temple. They're working with the Temple Mount Faithful and the Temple Institute. These groups have all the implements, the priestly garments, everything ready for sacrificial worship in their new temple. Every year the Temple Mount Faithful tries to set the cornerstone for the new temple. Of course, the Israeli police tell them, get away from here because you're going to cause a real turmoil up on Temple Mount because, you know, they can't do it yet. But they attempt it every single year because we're supposed to have a temple. With the temple, the Sanhedrin has a place to house themselves, and that gives a place for Elijah to come and announce the coming of the Messiah. Okay? Well, now you remember what we just read in Ezekiel about a coming king that's going to rule a united Israel? What line was that king supposed to be from? David. See, the Jews see that as prophecy of, we need to have a king ready to go to rule Israel when we become a united nation when the Messiah comes. So in order to facilitate that, in January of 2005, the Sanhedrin sent out a search for any male who could prove their descendancy from the line of King David. Now then, under the Jewish way of doing this, the female line is the line that they go through for the bloodline. Okay? So it's unusual for a male to be able to prove their descendancy from King David through the male line. That's the king line. That's the difference between Jesus' genealogy in Matthew and Luke. One is basically the female bloodline. The other one is the male king line. Because he says Jesus is from King David. So the Jews are going, we need to have a king ready. We need to know who the qualified people are to be the next king of Israel. And they have to be from the line of David. Well, it just so happens that one of the rabbis on the Sanhedrin can do that. Okay. Well, then Milton and Dinah Walling told me just a couple months ago, they live next door to a Jewish couple here in Amarillo, a young couple with a child. They are working right now to gain money to go back to Israel. That's their whole purpose. We want to go back to Israel. Well, guess what? He says he can determine his line all the way back to King David. So I always thought that'd be great. The next king of Israel will be from Amarillo. So.
Wait, when the temple was destroyed, I thought all the genealogy records were destroyed.
The paper records and all of that were, but the memory is still there. But the trick is, you know, they say with a high degree of certainty, you know, so that goes back into the records. We don't have the records, so we can't say for certain that this is how it went. But with a high degree of certainty through memory and family records, we can, almost every Jew knows which tribe they're from. The Levitical clan, the Levites, the priestly clan, the tribe, they know from family records, and DNA evidence now shows that members of the Levi tribe have a special marker on their genes that marks them as being of the Levitical clan. God knows who his priests are. He's known all along. He's still marking them. In March 2005, the Sanhedrin stated a formal statement that any disengagement of occupied territories is against Jewish law. That was right before Ariel Sharon pulled all the Jewish settlers and the Israeli forces out of the Gaza Strip. The Sanhedrin says, that's against Jewish law. God's given us that land is ours, and for us to disengage is against Jewish law. They still say that, and they're going to have another decision to make, because I know that Ehud Olmert and the Israeli government are going to start talking about withdrawing the Jewish settlers out of the West Bank. So they're going to have to address this again. So they're probably going to make another statement. In February of 2007, they put out a call to gather all legal, qualified sacrificial animals before Passover. They're ready to sacrifice. They're ready to begin temple worship again. They're ready for their third temple. They're ready today. We want to get it going. So, yes?
Well, if disengagement is against Jewish law, why did they give up the Gaza Strip?
Because Israel is run by a secular government.
Okay.
And for the sake of peace, let's do it. And let's give it one more effort. It's not going to work. And not only is it not going to work, it's going to cause more trouble, as we saw. It's already done it. So the Sanhedrin is right.
Uh-huh.
They're reading the Bible going, this is ours. You know, I've always wondered that, and I don't understand exactly. You know, they still, the Samaritan Jews are still sacrificing today. They've never quit. They sacrifice on top of Mount Gerizim. In John, where he talks to the Samaritan woman at the well, and she asked Jesus, you know, you say that we worship at the temple, but our people say that we worship on a mountain. She was talking about Mount Gerizim in Samaria. Well, the Samaritan Jews have been sacrificing up there every year for the last 3,500 years or whatever. So they don't have the Ark of the Covenant, yet the ritual of sacrificial worship is still being carried out. So I guess they see it the same way. We need a temple, even though it's not complete, we still go through the ritual. I don't fully understand it either. But it's fun to see all this. Yeah.
Are they worried about not having a high priest?
See, the high priest, of course, the Jews believe the next high priest will be the Messiah. So I guess once they get the temple ready and everything underway, they're thinking maybe he'll appear and he'll walk in and take over. Yeah, that's how they see it. They got everything else ready.
So the Israeli government, did they view the Sanhedrin as like a church group?
Yeah, so they don't take them serious. Because the Israeli parliament, the secular part of it, we're running the country. You take care of the religious stuff, we'll take care of everything else. They don't see it as all interlocked, just like the rest of the world.
So like separation of church and state.
Exactly. Exactly. Separation of church and state. In this case, separation of synagogue and state. So my point as we finish up today is, I mean, I don't know where all this is going. I don't know how long, you know, we're in for. I don't understand the timing at all. But what I think we see happening today is something that has not happened for 2,000 years. And I can't explain it apart from prophecy. I don't know how long, much longer it'll take, another 40 years, 50 years, 100, I don't know that. But I think it's awfully exciting to see this ingathering occur, these steps that the Jewish people are taking. They're going by Jewish law. We know what we're supposed to do, and they're fulfilling that. They're just going along just like the Old Testament tells them to do. So we're seeing things that have not happened in 2,000 years, and I can't explain it apart from the Bible. Any other questions? Next week we'll touch a little bit on the Islamic view of the end times and how they're playing into this. There's some really amazing things that have just come out in the last few months that you're just going, oh my goodness. So we'll touch on that, Temple Mount, and a little bit about Islam and how it all conjoins with all these times. So, anything else? Appreciate you being here. Let's have a word of prayer. Our dearest Lord, we thank you so much that we live in such exciting times where we see prophecy being fulfilled before our eyes. We just ask that you give us the wisdom to share your gospel of your Son Jesus Christ with everyone that we come in contact with. God, we know that these times are exciting and may be leading up to the end times. We don't know that. Help us to always stay focused on our purpose here, and that is to spread the gospel of your Son and be the best example that we can possibly be for everyone who we come in contact with. We thank you for your word that has given us these prophecies that sustains us until the end times. We look forward to your Son's return. In his name, amen.